This morning, we're going to, in a sense, do the second part of the Second Great Awakening. Last week, we covered parts of it, but there's some other emphases that I want to move to this morning. I call this lesson Revival and Revivalism. I'll explain that in just a minute. We had talked about last week that there were periods of awakenings that we have seen here in America. The world has seen periods of awakenings. I decided to put the chart back up in case we had visitors. And I think we do have one set of visitors, so I will put the chart up to tell you where we are. As most of you know, we've gone through the three periods of how we divide church history: the ancient church, the medieval church, which is very dated, the modern church history beginning with the time of Luther. We can date that. I've changed the things we put under modern church history a little bit, because in the second place, we did the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, rationalism, which was the challenge of the Enlightenment, and revivals. Revivals is where we were in talking about the evangelical awakening in England, the Pietism on the continent of Europe, and the Second Great Awakening really falls under revivals. But the last little subset under modern church history I've called revivalism, missions, denominationalism, and modernism. Now, revivalism is what we're going to deal with this morning. I hope when the morning's over with, you'll have some grasp of the difference in a revival and revivalism. Next week, Doug is going to bring a lesson on the modern missions movement, which began essentially at the beginning of the 19th century, where we are time-wise now. Following that, I'll go into several lessons on the denominations. Where did denominations come from? We may do a lesson on Baptist history. I'm not sure. God willing, next year I'm going to do about 30 lessons on Baptist history as a separate study that we've never done before. And so we'll see. But then we'll move into modernism, which is a catchword for the problems that affected the church in the 19th and 20th century concerning the authenticity of scriptures, the deity of Christ, the virgin birth of Christ, leading up to the big question mark of where are we today? God willing, we will finish the last lesson in this class, Memorial Day. We will talk about the 21st century and examine things that are happening in the church today. The closer you get to our time, the more difficult it is to be discerning as to what has happened, but we'll try to be discerning. The First Great Awakening, which we talked about several weeks ago, this was a definition Doug had used: a glorious work whereby God caused a period of intense spiritual revival and conversions that enlarged the church with true members and quickened them to Christian duty. This occurred beginning in the 1820s a little bit, essentially 1840-41 forward in the United States under the ministry of George Whitfield, Jonathan Edwards, Gilbert Tennant, and some other men. In England, the awakening was occurring, and you had Whitfield, Wesley, the Welsh men, etc. The awakening in the middle colonies was the 20s, the 30s was New England, the 40s and 50s, it extended to the southern colonies. Wish we could take time to talk about some of the southern preachers: Samuel Davies, who was Presbyterian, some of the Baptist men that were in the south. We'll get to them next year. The results of the Great Awakening, we said that you had an emergence of evangelism, or the evangelical movement. And we defined evangelical, we didn't define it. Even to be an evangelical, it's defined that you hold to the authority of Scripture, the necessity of the new birth, the intent to spread the gospel, and the fact that true conversion works itself out in the life of a believer. If you say you're a believer, you're converted, it will show in your life. Now, some people have put definitions on that beyond what I think Scripture does or what man can do. But these things are the essence of what an evangelical is. I'm not ashamed to be evangelical. I'm sorry that evangelicalism has been so eroded by the practice of certain people. In fact, there was an article this week that was quoted out of one of the blogs on the death of evangelicalism, the fact that because evangelicalism today is so marked by human perspective and by emotion and by a lack of doctrine that evangelicalism, as pressure comes, as America becomes truly a pagan nation, and that the evangelical voice is going to not only not be heard, but not be welcome to even speak in public. When it becomes not only unpopular, but unlawful to speak of the necessity of the new birth, which it is, you know, today in many places, and speak of the call of the law, what is the church going to do? And this author says it's going to wither up and fly away because it doesn't have substance behind it. He probably is right in that perspective. But we're evangelicals, and I don't think we're going to wither up and fly away. But from the Great Awakening, you had a concept of evangelical that was non-sectarian that spread beyond the borders of denominations. After the Great Awakening, the religious fervor in the United States, in the colonies, because we were not the United States then, certainly declined. Several reasons for the decline. We said the disruption of the American Revolution. It's tough to fight a war and go to church at the same time. The rise of English deism and French skepticism. The Enlightenment rationalism had reduced God to, at best, a deist God who was a watchmaker, who set the world in motion, but really was not involved. This was the position, frankly, held by some of our wonderful leaders like Jefferson and Franklin and Thomas Paine. It said that people preached against the world, the devil, and Thomas Paine, because he was so disruptive to an understanding of Christianity. The religious freedom versus uniformity and establishment, the church could not get its members by just being the church. For 1,400 years, it had. You were born in the community, you were born into the church. After the time of the Revolution, we had religious freedom. You were not born into a church. How was the church going to get its members? Finally, the Western migration, which is so very important to understand the total number of people that moved from one part of our continent to the other. Dr. Calhoun has said that one person called the Western migration, the Western lands, the land beyond the Sabbath. Well, what are the Western lands? This, in essence, is what you were looking at prior to about, as it says, 1763. Then you began to move. You moved into Kentucky, into Tennessee, into Indiana, way out west, in Ohio, and then way out west in Indiana. You had people moving at a just so rapid a pace that when they moved away from the church, they moved away from ministers. There were no ministers or very few to go with them. I don't think that they consciously moved away from Christianity, but they were put in a foreign wilderness area, and it was very difficult to maintain Christian principles. After this, we discussed the Second Great Awakening. We said the Second Great Awakening evidenced itself in three fairly distinct areas and movements. We spoke first about the East Coast and colleges. In 1787, at Hampton Sidney College in Farmville, Virginia, the Lord brought revival to five students who were praying in their dorm room. In fact, they were ridiculed. The president took them to his office. They continued praying. The Lord heard their prayer. These five guys were not even converted when they began to pray, but they knew they were in trouble and they needed something. Out of this, one of the five men was Archibald Alexander, who became the first head of Princeton Seminary when the seminary was formed, the first professor of theology. The Lord sent the Second Great Awakening not through the churches to begin with. In the East and the South, he sent it through the colleges. Following Hampton Sidney, you had the revival at Yale in 1809, Princeton in 1815. I mentioned Daniel Baker, who was a guy from Georgia, a student who went to Princeton, and he and several friends were praying because Princeton was such a godless place. There were more members of the Filthy Word Society or something like that, almost all of the students. And if you were a Christian, you were ridiculed. But God came in 1815 and sent revival there. Revivals were not only in the colleges, they were in the churches in the South and the East, but they also in the West and the Western frontier that we spoke about, you had the camp meeting revivals. Logan County, Kentucky, 1801, Cane Ridge, Kentucky, Logan County 1800, Cane Ridge in 1801. They were periods of intense preaching and intense conviction about sin and intense emotional response when the people came to Christ and felt their sins to be forgiven. We read an account of even the Lord doing that here in our own area at Crossroads in August of 1801 and Hallfields in October of 1801 at the time of the communion. They met at Hallfields for 5 days. They camped there and they were preaching and there was singing and there was revival. Now, in this response to the gospel, you did have excesses of emotion. And it's hard to judge and to sit back and say, well, surely that person was not converted. That person was. No one could be converted if they barked like a dog, if they had one limb that shook. I'm not going to say that, and I would suggest you not either, because it's unprovable. It even said in the minutes of the meetings from Hallfields that many of the people affected had continued in the way of the Lord. They had continued showing a change in their life. Now, the meeting at Hallfields was not marked with the barking and the shaking, I think, but out west in these camp meeting revivals and camp meetings, there was some pretty intense emotional things going on. This caused problem. Dr. Calhoun says that the pious were very busy singing. This was a quote of an eyewitness at Cane Ridge. Praying, conversing, falling down in ecstasies, and fainting with joy. All right, if this is happening, what's the preacher's response? The problems at Cane Ridge, as well as earlier problems, were due to preachers whose zeal was far in excess of their understanding. When you see the Lord doing that, then you begin to think, well, I can get to that if I just preach hell hot and heaven sweet. And you almost prepare the people for the emotional response. Many of the Presbyterian ministers drew back from this because they thought that the excesses were contrived. Some of them were contrived. It's impossible from our perspective to separate the two. The Lord did convert people. This did occur. There was 25,000 people at Cane Ridge, Kentucky in 1801. There was 5 to 7 men preaching at one time in various parts of the camp. We showed the picture last week of they would build like an elevated platform and the preacher would be there so that numbers could hear him. We just have to be careful about writing it off as all emotion because it was not all emotion. But there was emotionalism in it that was regrettable. How do you reject the regrettable parts of emotionalism without denuding the spirit and saying that the spirit cannot deal with a person and reduce them to weeping? I can't do that. Anyway, last week we did not get to the East Coast, New England, particularly New York, which was really the third leg of the Second Great Awakening. Didn't get there because, I didn't get there for several reasons. Oh, I should look at my notes. Out in the camp meetings, let's back up one. In the camp meetings in Western Revivals, there were a couple of new practices. The anxious seat was introduced. The anxious seat was not a place for sinners to come after a service. It was a place for sinners to come and sit during the service when the Lord moved them. They would come and sit in a particular place. Some even had a bullpen that they would sit in. I read the account this week of a man who was preaching, and he said about 25 people got up and started coming to sit down front. He didn't ask them to. He was not a man accustomed to this whatsoever. But they had heard of this practice that if you're concerned for your soul, come sit in a special place. That was very much a practice of the camp meeting revivals. Another thing was the naming of sinners. Sinners literally would be called out during the service. We'll deal with that in a little bit. The theology of these practices was not discussed by the men who employed them in the Western frontier because they worked. And they didn't care anything about the theology. They just thought it worked and they continued to employ them. As we come to talk about the Great Awakening in New England, we're going to come to look at the difference in the word revival and revivalism. A definition of revival, Solomon Stoddard, Jonathan Edwards' grandfather, said, "A revival is some special season wherein God doth in remarkable manners revive religion among his people." I think any of us could give a definition of revival similar to that. There are special times when God, in his sovereign purpose, comes to his people and he literally brings salvation to hearers. He warms the heart of ones who already know him. These are periods of revival. The church has seen this and has longed for this. But revivalism is different. Revivalism is something different both in its origin and its tendencies. Its ethos is man-centered, and its methods were too close to the manipulative to require a supernatural explanation. If you think of revivals today, you think of really revivalism. Because the definition or concept of revival that we were raised with in the South was something that you did once or twice a year. You called in an evangelist and he preached. You know, they used to preach all week. And then I noticed a few years ago revivals got shortened to Thursday through Sunday. And I think now they just have them for the weekend. I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. But what we called revivals was really revivalism. It was something that said it can be planned, it can be promoted, it can be carried out. James, I've lost his last name. He was a Scottish brother who was part of the Lord's moving in the New Hebrides in the 1950s. Is it James Stewart? I think his name was James Stewart. But I remember his quote when he was invited to America. This was in the late 50s. Late 50s, early 60s. He was invited to America, and he got to America, and he was riding down with his guest, and he saw a sign out front of the church, and it said revival, and it had a date to it. And he was thinking, wow, this is wonderful. Now, he had been part of a revival, okay? He'd been part of a God-sent revival, and he had never had the concept that you could have a revival. Well, having a revival is revivalism. It is part and parcel of our evangelical culture that we were raised with to think of this. And the fact is, and it's sad, that after the 1850s, revivalism replaces revival in the concept of American Christians. When you think of revival, you're really thinking of revivalism. You're not thinking of a biblical revival. Well, let's see what happened. The difference in the two. Going to New England, there's controversy that's going to arise. In New England, particularly in the western part of New York, there would be controversy. In New England, in the churches, there were five men that the Lord greatly used. We'll talk about one of them in detail in a minute. Asahel Nettleton was one. Lyman Beecher, Edward Payson, Edward Griffin, Gardner Spring. Of these five men, four of them were settled pastors. They were not itinerant evangelists going from place to place. They were pastors. And the Lord visited each of their churches with periods of revival. The writing of these men, particularly Gardner Spring, talked about the fact that true revivals were not planned. Quote, "Revivals are always spurious when they are, quote, got up by man's devices and not brought down by the Spirit of God." The preachers at this time amongst these men were truly soul doctors. They identified the needs of the soul and they applied Scripture to them. In Ian Murray's monumental book on revival and revivalism, which may be, short of his biographies, his most influential and long-lasting work, I believe. I'm sure they don't need my opinion about that. A tremendous book because he identifies the difference in the two. Talking about them being soul doctors, let me read a quote where he talked about Nettleton. Having heard the tidings, that is, Nettleton heard that there had been revival, but then there would be begun to be some of the spurious work. He said, I hastened to the spot with kind but decided severity. He called the people to order. My attempts by those who had given the work that turn were considered as very obtrusive and daring. It was reported all over town that a revival had begun in Salisbury and that I had put a stop to it. They seemed to be very much grieved and shocked at my conduct. I took a number of days to restore order, but when it was done, the work of God advanced silently and powerfully until all classes, the old, the young, were broken up. Not far from 300 were numbered as the hopeful subjects of divine grace at that day. These men dealt with souls. They took the word of God and applied it to people on a one-on-one basis at the end of the service and later. Nettleton would move into a town for 3 to 4 months, not for a week, and that's what his services would be. Well, let's take up the picture of Asahel Nettleton, born 1783. He was converted in 1801. He graduated from Yale in 1809, which has coincided with the time of Timothy Dwight, who was the president of Yale at that time. He was a bachelor. He never married. He was an itinerant evangelist. As I said, he would move into town for 3 to 4 months. He would hold meetings sporadically as he was in the town, but he would be available to visit the people. He would do the work of a pastor, in a sense, in the towns that he would move to. Dr. Haken, in his lectures on Nettleton, said that between 20 and 25,000 people were converted under his ministry, which extended to really the early 1830s. He became ill. He didn't minister very much in the last 10 to 12 years of his life. His preaching was powerful. It was intense. Let me read a description, a first-person description of Nettleton's preaching. I'm sorry. Yours truly put the wrong page number down. So you know what? I'm just going to tell you he was a good preacher. But it said that with his preaching was true to his Calvinistic theology. He laid out doctrines, but he laid out consequences of men not coming to Christ. He laid out the benefits of the gospel. He called men to Christ, but he didn't call men to overt public action. Controversy came in Western New York between Asahel Nettleton and a young man who had begun to preach. That young man was Charles Grandison Finney. This is a map of Western New York that we're going to be considering. This is not a very good one. This whole area in the western part of the state is considered the burned over district. This is another map that someone used to try to show and put in colors. Now, this is a modern map with these colorations. This is the burned over district, but this is another district that we need to deal with in here. The western part of New York was being populated in a rapid way around 1800. Consider this, in 1812, Rochester didn't exist. By 1830, Rochester was a trading center. They said that there were so many people going through Albany that at times you could see 1,200 people or 500 wagons at a time just heading west. They call Western New York a colony of New England because so many people were going to Western New York. There's a man who comes on the scene who is very instrumental in what things occur. That man is Charles Grandison Finney. This is a later picture. I think this picture was about 42 years old. Finney was born October 29th, 1792 in Warren, Connecticut. At age 2, he moves to New York State. From 1808 to 1812, he's a school teacher in Henderson, New York. 1812 to 14, he worked on his uncle's farm. 1814 and 15, he goes down to New Jersey to teach school again. 1818, he moves up to Adams, New York, to read law under a man by the name of B. Wright. So from 1818 to 1821, he read law. He was a very vocal opponent of the gospel. It is said that he went out of his way to stop people from believing, to ridicule people who attempted to believe. Michael Haken said he had a brilliant law-induced mind, and that he used the logic of the law, he thought, to stop people from making fools of themselves. Well, in 1821, something unusual happened. He was converted. The man who had stood in the way of others came to Christ. As soon as he came to Christ, he began to study for the ministry under a Presbyterian preacher named George Gale. Gale put him to reading and allowed him to begin to exhort. 1823, just 2 years later, he was licensed as an evangelist. That's why I went back to this. He was licensed as an evangelist in this county, in Upper Jefferson County, is where he was to be an evangelist in 1823. He was supported by the Female Missionary Society, is the one that supported Finney at this time to work as an evangelist. 1824, he marries. The fall of 1825, he moves down to Utica, New York, in Oneida County. He visits Reverend Gale, who had relocated there, with his wife. Gale wanted him to stay and preach, so Gale moves out of his study and makes his study a place that Mr. and Miss Finney could live. And they live there. And he began to go out and preach in the area. And it was very unusual what the Lord did. In Rome, New York, in the following year, it said that there were 500 added to the church. Now, Rome only had 4,000 people in it, but 500 were added to the church. The Lord did move under Finney's preaching. But Finney ran into some controversy. And the reason he ran into the controversy is because of some new measures that he had introduced. His new measures, which we'll discuss in a minute, were things like the anxious seek, the naming sinners by name. These had not been practiced in New York. They'd been practiced out west, but not in New York. Well, as the controversies came to Finney, the controversies were over these new measures. They were not over doctrine, but they were over the practices. Nettleton met Finney in late 1826 in Oneida. He didn't feel well, didn't even want to meet him, but he went. And he talked with him, and he found him somewhat resistant to Nettleton's questions about the methods that he was employing. He just literally didn't want to talk, Finney did, about anything that was questioning his movements. The following year, Finney preaches a message called, Can Two Walk Together Except They Be Agreed? Anyone who would question me uses arguments of worldlings. If you oppose what I'm doing and what the Lord is doing, you're only working like a worldling. You're not really a man of the Lord. Nettleton issues a letter. The letter was very nice. Wasn't a personal attack. But Finney was very, very upset. They had this New Lebanon conference called in July of 1827. Nettleton did not even want to go. He didn't want to attend, but he did. I'll read his comments to you about what was occurring at this little conference. I have been compelled by ministers to talk and exhaust all my strength and to spend nearly all my time for about 8 months on this subject, the subject of these new measures. I've done all that I can. I've been greatly blamed by many for what I've done. I have resigned the subject entirely to the management of settled pastors, whose business alone it is to determine the question, what measures shall be introduced into their churches. I have no controversy with any man on the subject, and I fear, if I attend, it will be construed into a personal controversy and that it will be impossible to avoid it. I fear that settled ministers at the East and South have not yet fully been exposed to these evils, to appreciate what's already been done here in the West, he's saying. When they see it, they will be obliged to take a decisive stand. The sooner I withdraw, he thought, and leave the whole responsibility on them, the better. He said, as an evangelist, it's not my place to talk about this. The settled pastors who see the results in their churches should deal with it. He did go, probably shouldn't have gone. Dr. Haken says that he wished that Nettleton had been more involved because he could have added clarity to the things that were done. But he didn't add clarity because he very sporadically attended like two of the sessions. In May of 1828, the following year, in Philadelphia, there was another conference. And at this conference, it was decided by the ministers pretty much that they would ignore what was going on. Let me read you the quote of Lyman Beecher. He says that the signatories, these men who signed this little document, agreed, quote, to cease from all publications, correspondences, conversations, and conduct designed and calculated to keep those subjects before the public mind and to induce our friends on either side to do the same. Otherwise, if we put our head in the sand, if we don't write about it, the controversy will go away. But obviously the controversy wouldn't go away because the controversy was rooted in practices that were very, very dangerous. What were these controversies rooted in? They were rooted in Finney's new measures. You know, I ought to say something before I go back. I'm sorry, I didn't notice. Can the controversies be explained in personal terms of Nettleton versus Finney? Some people think so. Some writers in this issue of Christian History kind of take the simplistic position that Nettleton was offended because Finney was having more, quote, success than he had had. That's not supported by any of the documents or any of the facts. It really seems that Nettleton was concerned about what was occurring in the hearts of people and what was occurring in the churches and what the results of this would be. Nettleton even wrote that he harbored no ill will on Mr. Finney. He said, the friends of Brother Finney are certainly doing him and the cause of Christ great mischief. They seem more anxious to convert ministers and Christians to their peculiarities than to convert souls to Christ. He goes on and says, Brother Finney's only been in the ministry 3 years. He hasn't had time to see the results of his methods. He hasn't had time to see the results of his preaching. But yet he has been put out in front as the one that's the leader of these new methods. Well, what were these new methods? What were the peculiarities of his new measures? One was the anxious bench. Now, the anxious bench, as I mentioned, had been used in the frontier before, but Finney brought it to New York. As he was preaching, people would get up, they would come. They would come to this place special. They would come after the service. There is a difference in telling someone to come to the anxious seat than it is to tell someone to come to Christ or to come even and talk to the minister after the service. It was customary for people to be told to come and speak with the minister, but not to come to a particular place for a particular thing. Even in the ministry of Dr. Lloyd-Jones, he would go back to his study and stand, and the deacons would let people into his study one at a time to speak with him in private after a service if people had concerns for their soul. I think it's valid for ministers to be available to speak to people who have concerns about their soul, more than just to shake their hand, but to actually talk to them. But Finney was not doing this, and the practice that he was bringing in was literally telling people to do something. Telling them to do something. Get them to break away from a source of pride, he said. This quote about from Finney: I'd often felt the necessity of some measure that would bring sinners to stand. Now, this is out of his own words now. I found also that something was needed to make the impression on them that they were expected at once to give up their hearts, something that would call them to act, and act as publicly before the world as they had in their sins, something that would commit them publicly to the service of Christ. He felt, in his opinion, that the anxious bench and calling people to the front was actually something that would keep spurious conversions from happening. Because he said, if you're allowed to sit there, you may think you're coming to Christ, but you really may not be. You still may be steeped in your pride. You need to get up and do something public. Make an act that you have the ability to do, which we'll discuss in a few minutes. And that seals the fact that you have come to Christ. We all know the results of this because most of us have been part of these results. He said you ought to preach to a man and get the man to be willing to do anything. That was the anxious bench of Charles Grandison Finney. Naming sinners in prayer. If someone would tell them that someone was going to be there, and the ministers would pray, and they would pray about the sin of that person out there. That was pretty bold, I would think. Pointed remarks to sinners in the service. I have a neighbor who won't come to church. He says to me, he says, if I come, they'd just talk about me. And I said to him, they're not going to talk about you. Now, they might talk about sinners, and you may think Gary's talking about you because it fits. But I said, I'll assure you, in 400 people, he's not going to be talking about you. Well, at this time, they would talk about people. I don't know if y'all, what your experience of invitation systems and all have been, but I remember one time as a teenager, I'd actually gone to a revival meeting at our home church, had my girlfriend with me, and I'm sure I probably was not paying a lot of attention. And, you know, when the invitation was given, and I don't remember how it was done, but I certainly didn't raise my hand that I was a Christian or anything. And a man came up to me and said, I noticed that you're probably not a Christian. I said, it's none of your business. And I said, if I need to talk to anybody, dude, I'll go talk to Frank McGuire. He's my pastor, preacher, whatever like that. Well, when the Lord saved me a few years later, I met this man again, and I actually preached for him. And I reminded him of that occasion that night. But he could see that I was certainly not in tune with what was going on. So he came up and tapped me on the shoulder afterwards. Well, you know, they would tap you on the shoulders during Finney's preaching out in the public. It was very blatant things. Well, what was at the heart of the controversy? What was the heart of what was going on at this time? I would say that Finney and his followers had a different doctrine of conversion. This is the conclusion that Murray makes in his book. They viewed conversion as something very different. Conversion is something that is a result of the use of reason and man's decision. Finney preached a sermon on Ezekiel 18:31, cast away from you all transgressions that you have committed. Make yourselves a new heart and a new spirit. Why will you die, O house of Israel? Asa Rand, the publisher of a newspaper in Boston, had scribes sitting there as Finney was preaching this. And, you know, they were all taking it down because Finney didn't publish anything. And they took the compilations, made it, and they published the sermon. This was the sermon. In the sermon, he's literally saying, change your mind. You have the ability to change your mind. Rand was writing about, this is what Finney said, a nature cannot be holy. The nature of Adam at his creation was not holy. Adam was made with a nature neither sinful nor holy. When he began to act, he made it his governing purpose to serve God. It was Adam's will, not his supposed nature, that controlled his actions. Finney declared what was true of Adam remained true for all men. A decision of the will, not a change of nature, was all that was needed for anyone to be converted. Finney literally confirmed Rand's analysis of his preaching because in his own lectures on revival, which he wrote many years later, he says, when God commands us to do a thing, it is the highest possible evidence that we can do it. He has no right to command unless we have the power to obey. God is tyrannical if he commands that which is impracticable. You see, Finney's view was that man could do what God was calling him to do. And for that reason, the preaching needed to be geared. The words needed to be geared to make man change his mind. Finney said, you need truth. He agreed. You needed to preach truth. But regeneration was affected by the agreement of man to the truth that he was hearing. Faith, in Finney's view, precedes regeneration. And therefore, you preach for man to exercise faith. When I taught this a couple of years ago, because I was listening to the CD, someone in the class, when I read those quotes, said, he just liked that, because he said, this is the result of what we're getting today. The decisionism from Finney, hooked with the higher criticism from Germany, takes the heart out of the gospel, and we get the results of where we are today. Finney realized that he was preaching a new theology. Finney did not mind admitting that he was preaching a new theology. Let me read you his words. He said, the truth is that very little of the gospel has come out upon the world for these hundreds of years without being clogged and obscured by false theology. What hubris that he thought that it had been all false theology up to that. He made it clear at this point that Nettleton had been one of the first, to suspect that the new measures were defended on the basis of a new theology. According to Murray, if conversion was the result of the sinner's decision, and if by inducing that decision was the responsibility of the preacher, assisted by the Holy Spirit, then any measure that would bring the unconverted, quote, right up to the point of instant and absolute submission, end quote, had to be good. For men to be converted, he argued, it is necessary to raise an excitement among them. Finney's own words, the object of the ministry is to get all the people to feel that the devil has no right to rule the world, that they ought all to give themselves to God and, quote, vote in, end quote, the Lord Jesus Christ as the governor of the universe. Now, what shall be done? What measures shall we take? Says one, be sure and have nothing that is new. Strange, Mr. Finney says. The object of our measure is to gain attention, and you must have something new. He wanted to get the sinner's attention, and he had something new. He said, come, come, come. And he gave them a place to come, where to come, and why to come. Revivals, according to Finney, were formerly regarded as miracles. For a long time, it was supposed by the church that a revival was a miracle, an imposition of divine power, with which they had nothing to do, and which they had no more agency in producing than they had in producing thunder or a storm of hail or an earthquake. It is only within a few years that ministers generally have opposed revivals were to be promoted but by the use of means designed and adapted specially to that object. It has been supposed that revivals came just as showers do, sometimes in one town, sometimes in another, and that ministers and churches could do nothing more to produce them than they could to make showers of rain come on their one town when they were falling on a neighboring town. Many people, listen to this, many people have supposed God's sovereignty to be something very different from what it is. They have supposed it to be such an arbitrary disposal of events, and particularly of the gift of the Holy Spirit, as precluded a rational employment of means for promoting a revival. And they cry out, you're trying to get up a revival in your own strength. Take care, you're interfering with the sovereignty of God. Better keep along in the usual course and let God give a revival when He thinks it's best. God is sovereign. It's very wrong for you to attempt to get up a revival. Well, Finney says that's wrong for people to take that view, because revival is something that could be brought about by the promotion and use of means. Now, as Reformed, we do not oppose means. We've always believed that the Lord uses means. The means He uses, first, is His Word. He uses prayer. He uses preaching. He uses exhortation. It may be in a college dorm room. It may not always be in the sanctuary of a church. In fact, probably is not always there. The Lord uses means, preaching, prayer, His Word. But to Finney, you don't have revival because you don't want one. You don't use the means that are really, really necessary. Finney said, talking about Whitney Cross, in his book, said, let's see, about Finney, gave an appeal for public action. He said that was the essential part of a revival, this appeal for public action. Finney's words about the sinner: the sinner has all the faculties and natural abilities requisite to render perfect obedience to God. All he needs is to be induced to use these powers and attributes as he ought. God cannot do the sinner's duty and regenerate him without right exercise of the sinner's own agency. Well, I think you can see from there the view that Charles Finney had of the nature of man. That Finney really believed that he knew he was introducing a new doctrine. He knew he was introducing reason above all. Reason, Finney says, it's only reasonable to appeal to man's reason. Finney's biographer, who was very, obviously favorable, G.F. Wright, says of Finney, Finney has left in literature a permanent record not only of his life, but also of his struggles to adjust the truths of Christianity into such a harmonious system of thought that no violence should be done to the dictates of reason. This, as he often said, was, after that of actual conversion of souls, the great aim of his life. He wanted to reduce doctrine so it didn't oppose the reasonableness of man. He knew he was changing doctrine. He knew that his new school ideas, the new school ideas of Nathaniel W. Taylor, that were intended to accommodate the gospel to culture and reason, had been brought to Finney. It made an immediate stress on him. Finney said that in times past, men had talked too much about God, about man's depravity. Nettleton agreed. You can talk about depravity to the point that men are not called to come to Christ. You can go into hyper-Calvinism. Nettleton agreed that might have been the practice of some of the churches. But you don't answer a practice with a practice that's even worse. Finney did. What do you think the results of his life? Well, I'll tell you a bit about his life. He goes on and finds a college in Oberlin, Ohio. He adopts strict health views. He gives up coffee. And he moves to a view of perfectionism. He has a second work of grace in 1842. He teaches a social action on behalf of the church, that the church should respond immediately to ills. He was for the abolition of slavery, which was right. And it's interesting that a result of this second great awakening, Dr. Calhoun says, is right from this period you have, as we mentioned last week, the Christianization of America. America becomes a Christian nation in the 1820s and 1830s. There were something like 37 weekly publications that were religious papers. Every denomination had multiple papers that were religious publications. America was Christianized, but America was also becoming inoculated to truth because the new measures produced spurious conversions. Finney said, in his own words, "I've gone back, and 6 months later, I have trouble finding my converts." His answer to that was, "All right, when they're converted, we immediately get them to join the church. We give them communion. We make them ushers. Get them involved so that they'll stay." But he realized that there were spurious things happening. His answer to that was not to examine his doctrine, but to try to rev up different practices. Dr. Lloyd-Jones, in a summation of this whole thing, wrote, "In the 1820s, a very subtle and unfortunate change took place, especially in the United States. From Asahel Nettleton's emphasis on revival to Charles Finney's emphasis on evangelism, there are two positions. When things were not going well, the old approach was for ministers and deacons to call a day of fasting and prayer, to plead with God to visit them with power. Today's alternative is an evangelistic crusade. Ministers ask, 'Whom shall we get as an evangelist?' Then they organize and ask God's blessing on this." Dr. Lloyd-Jones says, "I'm a member of the old school." Interesting, I was reading a blog post by a professor of evangelism at a Southern Baptist seminary, and he gave a review of the whole practice in the Southern Baptist Convention of a chair of evangelism, which was first introduced like in 1876, I think it was. And then you had a conference evangelist. Eventually you had evangelists appointed in each state, then evangelists appointed in each association. And these evangelists were to go around and literally get up revival. Revivalism became replaced with biblical revival. We want revival. We reject revivalism. Well, next week, Doug will do missions, which is a good thing. It came out of this period. And then I'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you for your attention.